This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. More than 1,400 Rohingya Muslim refugees were relocated to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal on Saturday. The move came despite opposition from human rights groups concerned about the site's vulnerability to storms and flooding. This brings to around 6,700 the number of Rohingya refugees that Bangladesh has moved to the island of Bashanchar since December. Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but some of the first group of refugees who were relocated spoke of being coerced. The government also says overcrowding in refugee camps in the mainland's Cox's Bazar district fuels crime. The Rohingya are a minority group who fled violence in neighboring Buddhist-majority Myanmar. Some refugees did tell journalists they moved to escape violence in the camps where they were previously housed and to have a better life. Hundreds of Tunisians marched in the capital on Saturday to protest against police abuses they say are endangering freedoms won in the 2011 revolution that swept away authoritarian rule. And hundreds of riot police confronted the demonstrators, leading to scuffles. There have been near daily protests since mid-January, the anniversary of Tunisia's revolution that sparked uprisings across the region in 2011, known as the Arab Spring. Tunisia was the only Arab state to emerge with a democratic system in place. Police have arrested more than 1,000 people during demonstrations over the past 2 weeks. The protesters are upset about many things, which include financial inequality and the marginalization of the poor. One protester said they want to steal the principles won since the revolution. He compared the current prime minister to an autocrat overthrown in 2011 after almost 25 years in power. This is VOA News. Russian businessman Arkady Rotenberg said Saturday that he owns a huge palace in southern Russia, which jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny had linked to President Vladimir Putin. Navalny and his anti-corruption foundation have published a video in which they allege the opulent mansion belonged to Putin. The video has been viewed more than 100 million times. Rotenberg is Putin's former judo sparring partner. He sold his stake in a gas pipeline construction firm in 2019 for a sum which RCB Business Daily put at some 75 billion rubles or $990 million. Rotenberg said he bought the palace 2 years ago. His announcement came in a video published by MASH channel Telegram. Putin has denied ownership of the palace, and Navalny was remanded in custody for 30 days on January 18th for parole violations. He says they trumped up, but he could still face years in jail. He was arrested after flying back to Moscow from Germany, where he had been recovering from a nerve agent poisoning last August. After Navalny's arrest, thousands of people joined unsanctioned protests across Russia last Saturday to demand the Kremlin release Navalny from jail. And here are a few more stories related to the global coronavirus pandemic. The Norwegian government will gradually loosen the capital region's coronavirus lockdown, allowing some shops and recreational activities to reopen from February 3rd onwards. That's what the health minister said on Saturday. The outbreak, the more contagious variant of COVID-19 first identified in Britain, had prompted the introduction of stricter measures on January 23rd, including the closure of all non-essential stores in and around Oslo for the first time during the pandemic. Taiwan's government on Saturday reported the island's first death from COVID-19 since May as it battles a small and unusual outbreak of locally transmitted cases. A woman in her 80s with underlying health conditions died after being infected with the coronavirus as part of a domestic cluster connected to a hospital. That's according to the island's health minister. And India reported its lowest active number of novel coronavirus cases in 7 months on Saturday, a year after the virus was first confirmed in that country. A year ago, a student from the southern state of Kerala tested positive for COVID-19 after returning from Wuhan in China. That's the global epicenter of the virus. For more on these stories, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, via Skype, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and our moderator is Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Lawmakers trigger the Trump impeachment trial, but there are increasing signs Democrats won't have enough Republican support to convict the former president. Also, Biden signs a flurry of executive orders. What does it tell us about the new president's agenda, and what can we expect from Biden's relationship with Congress? Plus, the Biden administration promising to boost vaccine supply, but getting enough shots into people's arms still proving to be a challenge. Molly, Linda, a real treat to have you both on this week, especially as we try and sort out some political gamesmanship on Capitol Hill. I know you both will help us get through the impeachment forecast and some other pressing topics. Let's dive right into impeachment. This week, Democrats triggered the start of the impeachment trial of, well, now former President Trump. It's his second impeachment trial, I might add. It's a very unique club. He's the only president to be facing two impeachment trials. There's one article of impeachment here charging Trump with incitement to insurrection over his role in the January 6th storming of the Capitol. Linda, give us the bullet points here. We'll get to the politics in a moment, but when is the trial likely to start? How long can we expect it to last? And do we have a sense of what Trump's defense might be?
The trial is due to start on February 9th, and given a vote that took place this week, that it was a measure from a Republican Senator Rand Paul trying to dismiss the trial, and that was defeated, but with only 5 Republican votes. So that is a very strong indication that Donald Trump will not be convicted when the trial does take place. And so the Democrats essentially just want to get this over with as quickly as possible. It might last a week. The timing is such that it obviously coincides with the beginning of President Biden's term. He faces massive crises on numerous fronts, and they don't want this to swamp Biden's agenda. As for Trump's defense, the first and foremost defense is that this is what they're doing is unconstitutional, that you can't have an impeachment trial of a president who's already left office. So they, I think, are hoping to avoid discussion of the substance of the charges, which is that he incited the riot at the Capitol on January 6th and get away from Trump's antics and inflammatory rhetoric.
The thing is, Molly, that right after the riot, you had some lawmakers on the Republican side blaming President Trump, people like Mitch McConnell, who rarely, if ever, said anything bad about Donald Trump. Kevin McCarthy, the leader of House Republicans, who has so closely aligned himself with Trump, even blamed Trump. But now you have this vote in the Senate that Linda mentioned, where most Republicans wanted to throw out the trial from the get-go. And you also seem to have Republicans who split with President Trump now walking that back. Why is that, Molly?
We've really seen the tide turn on this issue. As you said, it really did seem in the immediate aftermath of the attack, particularly before the new president was inaugurated, that there was a real willingness among Republicans, even quite senior and Republicans who'd been friendly to Trump, to turn on him and to try to sort of cast him out of the Republican Party. He remains a problem for the Republican Party going forward because of the divisions within their ranks, because you do have a sizable faction of the party that would like to reset its image because he is and has been so unpopular with the broader public. But then another sizable faction, and indeed most of the Republican rank and file Republican base, that remains quite committed and devoted to Trump. So I think the interesting questions are, as Linda mentioned, what we've heard from allies of the president is this procedural defense rather than trying to defend him on the substance, saying that on questions of process that the trial is itself illegitimate for technical reasons or for just sort of on a conceptual level that this isn't an issue we should be dealing with, we should be moving on, that if the new president wants to unite the country, He should not be focusing on these divisive questions of accountability for the past. The other thing I'm interested to hear going forward is when Trump does mount his official defense, he's retained a lawyer from South Carolina to speak for him in this matter and has a deadline coming up next week to officially answer the summons from Congress. Will he express any kind of contrition? We know he has this inability to express regret or apologize for pretty much anything. There is a real hunger among Republicans, even those who don't want to convict him, to see some sort of accountability, just to be able to say to the public, we didn't let this go unpunished since it was so serious and since lawmakers themselves were at risks.
But Molly, I just want to follow up with you. You've covered Trump these past 4 years. Do you really think he's going to apologize?
No. I don't make predictions, but that seems pretty in keeping with his personality. He's not somebody who expresses a lot of regret.
Linda, I want to go back to you. I think you both have been bringing up this point that the Democrats would like this trial to go as quick as possible, given that Republicans, they will not get, again, no predictions here. Republicans have done and said very unlikely that they'll get enough Republican support. So putting aside sort of the moral and ethical questions here about whether Trump is guilty, holding him accountable, from a purely political perspective, and we are talking about Washington politics matters here, what do Democrats gain from the trial if Trump, at the end of the day, is not convicted?
What Democrats gain is, in some ways, is a little bit of a sense of closure in their dealings with Donald Trump. Trump is no longer president, but this is them addressing one of his final acts of his presidency, which was, in the view of many, completely outrageous. So while they know that it's probably a losing proposition that they can convict him and potentially ban him from running for office again, I think they feel that what he did was just so egregious that it had to be dealt with, even if they're trying to get this over with quickly. You know, the downside for them is that it cuts into Joe Biden's message of unity, bipartisanship. There was, as Molly said, this early bipartisan agreement that what Trump had done was wrong. You did have a lot of top Republicans coming out against the president's rally on January the 6th, but that has quickly evaporated. And Donald Trump himself is now sitting in Florida and has set up his, quote, office of the former president. So he's acknowledging he's former and not really the rightfully elected president, and has had senior aides making phone calls to senators just to make sure they're still on the team, are not going to vote to convict. And oh, by the way, if you go against us, you might see a primary in your future.
We're already seeing Republicans in the House who voted to impeach. Other Republicans are trying to punish them for that. Molly, did you want to jump in with something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add really quickly. I mean, the public opinion is on the Democrat side here. Convicting Trump is popular with a solid majority of the public. It's not popular with Republicans, but it is popular with the broader public, Democrats, independents, swing voters. There is a really broad sense in polls and in public opinion that Americans saw this as an egregious national tragedy and do want someone held accountable and do believe that President Trump bears some blame here. So I think there is a real opportunity for the Democrats here in the Republicans not wanting to hold Trump accountable, because they can then go to voters and say, our country was attacked, America was attacked, the American government was attacked, and our opponents here, the Republicans, simply did not want to do anything about it.
And that seems to be something that Chuck Schumer, who now leads the Senate because the Democrats have the majority, has been saying, that he wants to get Republicans on record. Even if they don't vote to convict, it can be used against them in upcoming elections. Let's pause here and we'll take a break and we'll continue the conversation on the other side.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back to the show. Biden made unity a centerpiece in his inauguration speech, bringing the country back together, working with the other side. He's been in office about 10 days or so. It's not that long of a time. But in those 10 days, Linda, what steps, if any, has Biden taken to reach out to Republicans? And on the flip side, are Republicans interested in working with Biden?
Joe Biden, I don't know that he's done a whole lot of outreach yet. His main activity since taking office has been to sign a whole lot of executive orders, which are things that he can just do with his signature, doesn't need congressional approval. A lot of it is the reversal of the Trump agenda, rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, canceling the Keystone XL pipeline, canceling the so-called Muslim travel ban, reaffirming a program that was instituted under President Obama, providing deportation protection for young undocumented people in this country. One of the norms of the early days of a presidency, which is that the new president sits down and signs a whole lot of orders, either to undo the previous president from the other party or to just put in place things that he wants to really lay down that marker, things that don't need congressional approval. Of course, there's a lot that needs Congress to weigh in, and that upcoming very quickly is the COVID relief package. The pandemic is front and center on his agenda, and they are moving now to pass legislation in Congress, potentially actually as two bills, one that they are hoping to get with bipartisan support.
A lot to unpack in your answer, and we're going to touch on a lot of those points, but I want to stick with unity for a moment, Molly. Biden said he would be president for those who did not vote for him. 74 million Americans did not vote for him. It doesn't seem likely that Biden can win over people steeped in conspiracy theories, the ones who marched on the Capitol. But there are plenty of Republicans who did not think the insurrection was a good thing at all, and there are polls to back that up. But they're just not Democrats. They hold conservative ideals. They feel increasingly alienated by the mainstream discourse. So how does and can Biden win them over? And then in addition, what can be done about this growing conspiracy theory problem that's a really big internal problem for the Republicans?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different levels to this unity question. We heard in President Biden's opening address him trying to say what he meant by this idea of unity, that it, of course, is not going to mean unanimity. It, of course, is not going to mean that everybody suddenly agrees on the direction forward for the country or how the Congress should govern when it comes to issues, or that he gets 100% of the vote the next time he's on the ballot. He doesn't expect 74 million Americans to suddenly wake up and be Democrats. But he did, he said, want to end this quote-unquote uncivil war. He wanted to, unlike his predecessor, set a unifying tone in his rhetoric and to send a message that the changes he is making to the government are intended to help everybody, that where Trump often would do things and say point blank that this was something he was doing for his supporters and not for the rest of the country, even in some cases seeking to punish blue states and their governments and their residents in the policies that he enacted. This administration is trying to say to the public, we're doing this for everyone. We want to help everyone. The policies we're making are intended to help everyone. And those 74 million who didn't support him, that he still views them as Americans who should be part of his governing vision. Now, is that convincing to people? I doubt it, frankly. And what we are seeing from Republicans is very much a replay of 2009, where they correctly saw that the president's promise of bipartisanship and coming together in Washington was something they could veto, was something that they could say, well, if we don't go along with it, look, you're not accomplishing your goal. And so we've heard a lot of rhetoric from Republicans to that end. But on the policy question, on the governing question, there are talks going on between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate to see if they can come up with some agreement. But there's also talks that are exclusively among Democrats about how they can pass the COVID relief and other policies on a party line vote. So I think it's really an open question which way this thing is going to go on Capitol Hill.
Right. And you have Republicans saying it's not all rhetoric. We want to see actual concrete steps taken by the administration, although rhetoric does matter. We've seen that in the past 4 years. And it's not all on Biden, of course, Linda. I mean, the Republican Party is having this fight internally. You have Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. A new report now says that she supported executing Democrats on her Facebook page before she was elected. That doesn't exactly scream unity. Mitt Romney, the senator from Utah, the Republican senator, he's saying that Republicans who were spreading lies about election fraud shouldn't be complaining about the Democrats inflaming and dividing the country. So the Republicans have to figure this out amongst themselves as well.
Absolutely. No, the Republican Party is in a state of turmoil. They're out of power. from both the White House and in both chambers on Capitol Hill. You have fringe members. There's no other way to put it. People like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert. These are both freshman women members. You had Lauren Boebert, you know, she carries a gun, which is controversial to say the least. And then you have the few Republican members who are willing to speak out in a very public way, like Mitt Romney, trying to kind of hold on to that old style collegial establishment Republicanism. Even if there are policy disputes, you can still have a reasonable conversation. So the party is, you know, they're trying to keep it all together, but at the same time, it's really hard in this day of social media and 24/7 media in general to keep the people that are on the fringe from getting a lot of attention.
Right. They have a massive platform on social media. Anything they can say gets retweeted and liked, et cetera. Molly, I want to go back to Linda brought up this slate of executive orders that Biden has signed in his first days. It's funny, not haha funny, but funny in sort of a Washington way, because Obama was heavily criticized for relying on executive orders. Democrats then criticized Trump for doing the same thing. And now Biden is getting that same criticism. But sort of putting aside that criticism, is there an issue here with Congress conceding control and the executive sort of taking that control away from Congress?
Yeah, in broader terms, this is a decades-long trend, and it does come from both sides, right? You've had presidents increasingly seeking to act unilaterally, while Congress is increasingly gridlocked and incapable of doing anything or very much when it comes to policymaking. You know, you have the Congress saying, well, the president shouldn't be doing this. This is our job. And the president saying, well, why don't you do your job then? Why make me do it? Biden has set a record for the amount of executive orders and actions he's taken. It's now just over a week on the job. Most of those executive orders, however, and actions are simply undoing or unwinding actions that Trump had taken unilaterally, because over the course of his presidency, he did on many occasions set annual records for the number of executive orders and actions that he took, which Democrats criticized as a sort of, you know, imperial presidency approach, that he simply wanted to do things unilaterally because he believed himself to be the sole authority. So, you know, if Congress wanted to take back these powers, it could. And there are some in Congress who would like to see that. And there is some legislation pending to that effect. I don't see it being a huge subject of conversation on Capitol Hill. But I think this is something that we have seen going on for years and years in terms of the balance of power between the executive and the legislative branches.
Right. And as you mentioned, it's not only that Congress is ceding control, but it also, these executive orders can be overturned with the next administration. They don't really have lasting power as legislation does. I want to go to some pieces of legislation that are pending right now, specifically the COVID relief package. Linda, I think you brought this up. It's a big bill. I think it's $1.9 trillion, if I'm not mistaken. What's in it? Any chance of it passing? What's the Biden team doing to try and get Republicans on board?
So it contains a lot related to COVID directly. It enhances the stimulus payments to Americans who make under a certain amount to kind of plus up the amount that was given in the final package of the Trump administration. That's huge. You've got money in there to ramp up production of vaccine, to enhance the distribution, to increase the number of vaccinators. And then it also contains a piece that's rather controversial, which is to establish a $15 an hour minimum wage across the country. I tend to think that was thrown in there to make a statement, and then they'll give that away when all is said and done. But that is a long-held policy goal of Democratic progressives, the left wing of the Democratic Party. And this is something that the Biden administration is very keen to do. The Democrats have their own internal divisions and wings. Just as the Republicans are trying to keep it all together, so are the Democrats. And Biden, who's the classic Democratic centrist, he knows that he's with such slim majorities in both houses of Congress, he really needs to keep all of his people on board with him, including the most liberal.
Yeah, intra-party fighting is not unique to one side. While the White House and legislatures and lawmakers sort of hash this out, this COVID relief bill, the Biden administration has also put out their broader COVID plan, the cornerstones of which are faster testing, health equality, and boosting vaccinations. It's ambitious, although some health experts say on the vaccine front, it's not ambitious enough. Biden had been promising 100 million vaccines in his first 100 days. Experts say that number has to be much larger. Biden seems to be signaling now he wants to move past that goal. In general, Molly, what challenges does Biden face rolling out his COVID plan?
pretty much all of them. You know, the Trump administration rather deservedly did not have a very good reputation in this regard. The president was notoriously disengaged with the management of the pandemic. So we have seen the new administration really scrambling to reorient the course of things. They were accused when they first came in of sort of trying to be a little too cute by half with the expectation setting. We were already at a level above a million vaccinations a day by the time Joe Biden took the oath of office. So to say that he was going to get to that level was not really setting himself anything to strive for. And we have now seen the administration increase that. But the vaccination rollout has been slow. It has been difficult. It has been inconsistent across states. There has been a lot of waste and difficulty in the process. And we see the new administration talking a big game about really sort of making this a wartime effort type of surge using FEMA and so forth. It has yet to really materialize. And I think that's going to be, the proof is going to be in the pudding of whether they can really show that they have put some urgency into this using, you know, the Defense Production Act, using disaster funds to purchase more vaccines. I think this is something we're going to see in the coming weeks and months. Are they able to really turn this around and show the American people that they're serious about making this process really work?
And to that point, politicians can spin a lot of things. And we saw this trip up Trump as well. He promised at a certain point, any American who wants to get a test can get it. But then a lot of Americans who went out and tried to get a test saw that it wasn't so easy. And the same thing is, I'm assuming, is going to happen with Biden. He's promising that by spring, any American that wants a vaccine should be able to get it. But if by spring, Americans still are having a hard time getting vaccines, mm-hmm. the blame is going to be with Biden, no matter what Trump did going in. I mean, the buck will stop with Biden on this, right, Linda?
Absolutely. I think the whole ballgame for President Biden, if he is not perceived as having made serious progress, really turning around the American response to COVID, I think his presidency is effectively over. This is such a massive crisis, and they know this. In some ways, it's been extraordinary how, you know, we seem to see the waving of a wand. The Trump team left, the Biden team came in. We're now getting regular briefings. Anthony Fauci, the infectious disease expert, can now speak freely. He's not feeling undermined and undercut by the administration. The messaging is extremely important. The public has to feel that the government at all levels is doing everything they can to get people vaccinated and to stop this.
The last question I have on this, Molly, is the challenge of getting schools open. The Biden team has said reopening schools is a priority, but they're getting a lot of pushback from school unions, from teacher unions, I should say. Teacher unions in big cities want to keep schools shut indefinitely, which goes against what the CDC is saying. A new CDC report out that you can reopen schools if you put in the right measures. It is possible to do this. You're having reports now. The New York Times just had this heartbreaking article about a spike in teen suicides. I think it was in Las Vegas. Kids can't go to school. Suicides are going up. Teachers unions have a lot of power, though, in the Democratic Party, especially on a local level. So how does Biden balance pleasing those unions? But also, there are a lot of parents who are really upset who will have a lot of power when it comes to the next election.
That's right. You know, I think that question of where the public is on this issue and where public pressure has been applied is really important, because in a lot of these districts, and the parents are the ones driving a lot of this. The policymakers who've been accused of sort of caving to the unions, they in a lot of cases have public pressure on their side. And so I think the most important thing here is going to be rebuilding the trust with the public to say, we're not politicizing this process. We are being responsive to the science, and the science says we can do this, because you have a lot of parents who just don't believe that. You have a lot of parents that when the teachers and their unions say, we don't think this is safe, they believe that, even if it's not necessarily true, because there has been so little trust in a lot of these communities, particularly those big cities that you're talking about, for the messages that were coming out of the Trump administration. So while it is true that the unions have been a big player in this, they see themselves as, you know, protecting the health and safety of their members. For example, Washington, D.C. right now, trying to open schools in person, there's a real question about whether any kids are going to show up in those schools. schools or whether parents are going to continue to choose to keep their kids home because they simply don't trust what they're hearing from the government about where the science is and whether it's safe.
It just goes to show what a challenge the Biden administration is facing, getting people to even trust the basic science that's coming out. That's all the time we have. Thanks to Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Shayna Stulen. This program is produced by Voice of America. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Katie Weaver and John Russell. Later, Armin Kasabian answers a question from a learner in the latest Ask a Teacher. We close our show with an American story. This week, it is The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving. But first,
China's government is facing growing criticisms about the country's vaccines and its early COVID-19 actions. Now, some experts say the government is spreading dangerous misinformation to deflect that criticism. Chinese state media have recently published stories suggesting that Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine may not be safe. The vaccine passed through several safety trials last year as part of an approval process. Last week, a Chinese official spoke about a theory that the new coronavirus may have come from an American military lab. Such issues are getting media attention because of the rollout of vaccines worldwide. Also, a World Health Organization team recently arrived in Wuhan, China, to investigate the beginning of the virus. Some of these theories are finding a wide audience within China. For example, the social media hashtag America's Fort Detrick was seen 1.4 billion times last week. Fort Detrick is a biological weapons laboratory in the U.S. state of Maryland. The Communist Youth League created the hashtag after a Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson suggested the virus came from the lab and urged the WHO to investigate.
U.S.-based reporter Fang Shimin said the media activity is an effort to move blame for the health crisis from China to the United States. Fang is known for reporting on dishonesty in China's science industry. The tactic is quite successful because of widespread anti-American sentiment in China, Fang said. Yuan Zeng is an expert on Chinese media at the University of Leeds in Britain. She said the government's stories spread so widely that even well-educated Chinese friends have asked her if the reports might be true. Creating doubts and spreading unproven theories might add to public health risks as governments try to reduce unease about vaccines, Yuan added. That is super, super dangerous, she said.
Chinese state media called for an investigation into the deaths of 23 old people in Norway after they received the Pfizer vaccine. CGTN, the English language station of state broadcaster CCTV, and the Global Times newspaper accused Western media of ignoring the news. Health experts say deaths unrelated to the vaccine are possible during mass vaccination campaigns. WHO investigators found that the vaccine did not play a part in the Norway deaths. The state media coverage followed a report by researchers in Brazil who found a Chinese vaccine to be less effective than expected. Researchers at first said Sinovac's vaccine was 78% effective, but the scientists changed that to 50.4% after including cases of minor sickness. It's very embarrassing for the government, Fang said in an email. As a result, China is trying to raise doubts about the Pfizer vaccine and increase support for its own vaccines, Fang said.
Top Chinese government officials have openly voiced concerns about the mRNA vaccines developed by Western drug companies. They use a newer technology than the more traditional method of the Chinese vaccines currently in use. In December, the director of the Chinese Centers for Disease Control, Gao Fu, said he cannot be sure that mRNA vaccines do not cause risky side effects. There are safety concerns, he said. The Pfizer mRNA vaccine and another one developed by Moderna have passed trials in which they were tested on more than 70,000 people. The WHO team's arrival in Wuhan has led to a renewal of accusations that China failed to deal with the virus early enough. Critics say the lack of action permitted COVID-19 to spread worldwide. They note that Chinese officials even punished doctors who tried to warn the public about the virus. The WHO researchers began fieldwork this week after being released from a 14-day quarantine.
The Communist Party sees the WHO investigation as a political risk, said Jacob Wallace. He is a senior expert at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. The party wants to move attention away from the investigation. It is doing so by changing the story on where responsibility lies for the emergence of COVID-19, Wallace said. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying added to that effort last week by urging the WHO to also investigate the U.S. military lab. State media have made note of past events at the lab, but China has provided no hard evidence of a link between the lab and the appearance of the coronavirus. If America respects the truth, then please open up Fort Detrick and make public more information about the 200 or more biolabs outside of the U.S., and please allow the WHO expert group to go to the U.S. to investigate, Hua said. State media published her comments. They became one of the most popular issues on China's Sina Weibo.
China is not the only government to blame the pandemic on other countries. Former U.S. President Donald Trump often tried to reduce blame for his administration's actions during the crisis. He said last year he had seen evidence the virus came from a Wuhan laboratory. Many experts think that theory is unlikely. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Italy reopened its famous antiquarium this week. The museum was created to keep and show objects from the ancient city of Pompeii. Life in Pompeii ended almost 2,000 years ago, after a massive burst of the nearby Mount Vesuvius volcano. The city was quickly buried by ash and lava. Many people were immediately killed. In fact, scientists found some human remains had turned to glass because the heat from the explosion was so intense. For many years now, specially trained scientists called archaeologists have been digging in the area that was once Pompeii. It is now an archaeological park. The antiquarium was created in the 1870s as a place to keep the findings. For many years, visitors were able to see some of the frescoes unearthed by archaeologists, as well as everyday objects that the people of Pompeii used. Bombings in World War II damaged the museum. Then, in 1980, a deadly earthquake shook the park. Officials were forced to close the antiquarium. It had remained closed until now. Current COVID-19 restrictions bar most people from visiting the newly reopened museum. Only visitors from Italy's Campania area, which includes the city of Naples and the Pompeii ruins, are permitted to enter. Pompeii has long been one of Italy's top tourist sites. When the tourism industry fully reopens, admission to the ruins will also include a visit to the antiquarium. The reopening of the museum after so many years is a sign of great hope during a very difficult moment, said Pompeii's longtime director, Massimo Osanna. On show in the last room of the museum are casts from the remains of some of Pompeii's citizens. Osanna said that part of the museum is emotionally powerful for him. Much of ancient Pompeii remains to be discovered at the park. Although tourism has halted during the pandemic, archaeologists have kept working. Just 1 month ago, Osanna announced the discovery of an ancient fast food restaurant at Pompeii. Archaeologists were able to fully uncover the eatery. The find helped researchers learn about the food Pompeii's citizens enjoyed. Researchers even discovered what was for sale at the restaurant on the day the lively city met its explosive end. I'm John Russell.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Jack, who is in China. Hello. We use the word strong to describe a person and a team. Can we use it to describe a country? Dear Jack, as you know, strong is an adjective. It describes something that has power or something that cannot easily be broken, damaged, or destroyed. You are right. English speakers use the word strong to describe a person or a team. We can also use it to describe a country. However, describing something with the adjective strong does not necessarily mean it is good. Strong can describe things that are good or bad. In fact, almost anything can be strong. For example, people can be strong, but things like teeth, bones, and muscles can be strong too. The wind can be strong. Here is an example.
The weather report says there will be strong winds tomorrow.
Strong can describe feelings also. You can have a strong feeling about someone, some event, or issue. You may even feel you know what may happen in the future. Like this.
I have a strong feeling about our team winning the championship.
Strong can also be used to describe bad qualities. For example, imagine you painted a room and your friend comes in and says,
"The paint smell is too strong. Open the window, please."
Strong can mean something that is hard to fight against. Many students might understand this example.
When I sit in the classroom for a long time, I have a strong desire to sleep.
So, the adjective strong can be used to describe good things and bad ones, too. Well, Jack, we hope this helps to answer your question. And to our listeners everywhere, what question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Armin Kasabian.
Today's story is called The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. It is about something strange that happened long ago in a valley called Sleepy Hollow. It was written by Washington Irving. The story is told by Doug Johnson.
The valley known as Sleepy Hollow hides from the world in the high hills of New York State. There are many stories told about the quiet valley, but the story that people believe most is about a man who rides a horse at night. The story says the man died many years ago during the American Revolutionary War. His head was shot off. Every night he rises from his burial place, jumps on his horse, and rides through the valley looking for his lost head. Near Sleepy Hollow is a village called Tarrytown. It was settled many years ago by people from Holland. The village had a small school and one teacher named Ichabod Crane. Ichabod Crane was a good name for him because he looked like a tall bird, a crane. He was tall and thin like a crane. His shoulders were small, joining two long arms. His head was small, too, and flat on top. He had big ears, large, glassy green eyes, and a long nose. Ichabod did not make much money as a teacher. and although he was tall and thin, he ate like a fat man. To help him pay for his food, he earned extra money teaching young people to sing. Every Sunday after church, Ichabod taught singing. Among the ladies Ichabod taught was one Katrina Van Tassel. She was the only daughter of a rich Dutch farmer. She was a girl in bloom, much like a round, red, rosy apple. Ichabod had a soft and foolish heart for the ladies, and soon found himself interested in Miss Van Tassel. Ichabod's eyes opened wide when he saw the riches of Katrina's farm. Miles of apple trees and wheat fields, and hundreds of fat farm animals. He saw himself as master of the Van Tassel farm, with Katrina as his wife. But there were many problems blocking the road to Katrina's heart. One was a strong young man named Bram Van Brunt. Bram was a hero to all the young ladies. His shoulders were big, his back was wide, and his hair was short and curly. He always won the horse races in Tarrytown and earned many prizes. Bram was never seen without a horse. Sometimes, late at night, Bram and his friends would rush through town shouting loudly from the backs of their horses. Tired old ladies would awaken from their sleep and say, "Why, there goes Bram Van Brunt leading his wild group again." Such was the enemy Ichabod had to defeat for Katrina's heart. Stronger and wiser men would not have tried, but Ichabod had a plan. He could not fight his enemy in the open, so he did it silently and secretly. He made many visits to Katrina's farm and made her think he was helping her to sing better. Time passed, and the town people thought Ichabod was winning. Brahm's horse was never seen at Katrina's house on Sunday nights anymore. One day in autumn, Ichabod was asked to come to a big party at the Van Tassel home. He dressed in his best clothes. A farmer loaned him an old horse for the long trip to the party. The house was filled with farmers and their wives, red-faced daughters, and clean, washed sons. The tables were filled with different things to eat. Wine filled many glasses. Bram Van Brunt rode to the party on his fastest horse, called Daredevil. All the young ladies smiled happily when they saw him. Soon, music filled the rooms, and everyone began to dance and sing. Ichabod was happy dancing with Katrina as Bram looked at them with a jealous heart. The night passed. The music stopped, and the young people sat together to tell stories about the Revolutionary War. Soon, stories about Sleepy Hollow were told. The most feared story was about the rider looking for his lost head. One farmer told how he raced the headless man on a horse. The farmer ran his horse faster and faster. The horsemen followed over bush and stone until they came to the end of the valley. There, the headless horseman suddenly stopped. Gone were his clothes and his skin. All that was left was a man with white bones shining in the moonlight. The stories ended, and time came to leave the party. Ichabod seemed very happy until he said good night to Katrina. Was she ending their romance? He left feeling very sad. Had Katrina been seeing Ichabod just to make Brom Van Brunt jealous so he would marry her? Well, Ichabod began his long ride home through the hills that surround Tarrytown. He had never felt so lonely in his life. He began to whistle as he came close to the tree where a man had been killed years ago by rebels. He thought he saw something white move in the tree. But no, it was only the moonlight shining and moving on the tree. Then he heard a noise. His body shook. He kicked his horse faster. The old horse tried to run, but almost fell in the river instead. Ichabod hit the horse again. The horse ran fast and then suddenly stopped, almost throwing Ichabod forward to the ground. There, in the dark woods, on the side of the river where the bushes grow low, stood an ugly thing, big and black. It did not move, but seemed ready to jump like a giant monster. Ichabod's hair stood straight up. It was too late to run, and in his fear, he did the only thing he could. His shaking voice broke the silent valley. "Who are you?" The thing did not answer. Ichabod asked again. Still no answer. Ichabod's old horse began to move forward. The black thing began to move along the side of Ichabod's horse in the dark. Ichabod made his horse run faster. The black thing moved with them. Side by side they moved, slowly at first, and not a word was said. Ichabod felt his heart sink. Up a hill they moved above the shadow of the trees. For a moment, the moon shone down, and to Ichabod's horror, he saw it was a horse. And it had a rider. But the rider's head was not on his body. It was in front of the rider, resting on the horse. Ichabod kicked and hit his old horse with all his power. Away they rushed through bushes and trees across the valley of Sleepy Hollow. Up ahead was the old church bridge where the headless horseman stops and returns to his burial place. "If only I can get there first, I am safe," thought Ichabod. He kicked his horse again. The horse jumped onto the bridge and raced over it like the sound of thunder. Ichabod looked back to see if the headless man had stopped. He saw the man pick up his head and throw it with a powerful force. The head hit Ichabod in the face and knocked him off his horse to the dirt below. They found Ichabod's horse the next day peacefully eating grass. They could not find Ichabod. They walked all across the valley. They saw the footmarks of Ichabod's horse as it had raced through the valley. They even found Ichabod's old hat in the dust near the bridge. But they did not find Ichabod. The only other thing they found was lying near Ichabod's hat. It was the broken pieces of a round orange pumpkin. The town people talked about Ichabod for many weeks. They remembered the frightening stories of the valley, and finally they came to believe that the headless horseman had carried Ichabod away. Much later, an old farmer returned from a visit to New York City. He said he was sure he saw Ichabod there. He thought Ichabod silently left Sleepy Hollow because he had lost Katrina. As for Katrina, her mother and father gave her a big wedding when she married Brahm Van Brunt. Many people who went to the wedding saw that Brahm smiled whenever Ichabod's name was spoken, and they wondered why he laughed out loud when anyone talked about the broken orange pumpkin found lying near Ichabod's old dusty hat.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.